Okay, let's just jump right in. I want you to picture this. It's the early 1970s. You're in rural Idaho, and there's a potato field.
Right?
And right next to this potato field is this, well, this kind of rundown apartment building. Inside, you've got two dozen 19-year-olds.
They're sleep deprived.
Totally. They're wearing suits that are probably a size too big, and they're taking cold showers behind these flimsy plastic curtains because there are no actual doors on the stalls.
And this is the crucial part. They are desperately trying to memorize a language where if you misplace a single letter, your sentence about meeting people suddenly becomes about killing people.
Exactly. This isn't military boot camp, though. Our sources make that comparison more than once. We're doing a deep dive today into a really fascinating piece of history, the Language Training Mission, or the LTM.
Yeah, specifically that Pink Palace era. We're looking at the experience of missionaries who were headed to Finland, oh, between about 1971 and 1978.
It was this really specific high-pressure crucible. Our main source is this compiled narrative called Five LTM Experiences by the Missionaries.
And this is not the polished, PR-friendly version of missionary work you might be used to. This gets into the grit, the absolute terror of the language barrier, and, well, this strange mix of spiritual intensity and just teenage hijinks.
Right, because usually you just get the highlight reel.
Yeah.
But this source zeroes in on one group that went to the Salt Log Mission home first and then up to Rexburg, Idaho. So we're going to talk about the Pink Palace, the absolute nightmare of Finnish grammar,
Yeah.
and yes, a breakup letter that involves a mustache.
But if you zoom out, this whole deep dive is really a case study in resilience. It's about this gauntlet physical, emotional, linguistic that was designed to turn these typical American kids into disciplined representatives of their faith.
In a country that was, I mean, culturally and linguistically, just on another planet.
Totally.
So let's start where they did, the Salt Lake Gauntlet. The source material makes the arrival at the Salt Lake Mission home sound.
Well, intense. Elder Bruce Shalgi described it, right?
Yeah. He talks about dragging in these heavy suitcases and hitting this strict no parents beyond this point rule. He said everyone looked like they had just had their wisdom teeth removed.
That is such a perfect way to describe shell shock, isn't it? For a lot of these kids, this was it. This was the moment childhood just ended.
You walk through those doors, and boom, you're in the sea of hundreds of bunk beds, instant institutional living.
And the attrition started, I mean, right away.
Shelley says he climbs into his bunk, says hi to the guy above him, and the guy just looks down and says, "I'm going home."
Wow. Just like that.
Just like that. So the Finland group dropped from 25 to 24 before a single class even started. The stakes are set,
Absolutely.
but the logistics of the mission home were wild to me. It sounds like a whole city built underground.
Well, it was all about efficiency. The mission home was connected by these tunnels to the church office building, the temple, the Hotel Utah.
So they wouldn't have to let thousands of missionaries just wander around downtown Salt Lake.
Exactly. It was like an assembly line. They just moved them through these tunnels.
And the food situation really paints that picture. They'd walk through a tunnel to a basement ballroom in the Hotel Utah, and the food was just stacked in covered plates along the wall.
Very industrial. Eat, move, learn, repeat.
And the learning was not a gentle on-ramp. The pressure was on from minute one.
Oh, yeah. The mission home president would get them all in a room, point to a blackboard, and bam, the entire text of Doctrine and Covenants, section 4.
Which is the foundational scripture for this work. Now behold, a marvelous work is about to come forth.
Right. But he didn't just want them to read it. He says, "You have 7 days. Memorize this perfectly." And his teaching method was brutally simple.
Every day he'd just erase a few more words from the board.
Sink or swim.
Totally. But while this is happening, this brute force memorization, they're also going through this really intense spiritual conditioning. The schedule says they woke up between 4:00 a.m.
To go to the temple. And back in the 70s, the endowment sessions were longer, about 3 hours.
So you have sleep deprivation, you're fasting, you have high stakes memorization, and then long periods of really deep spiritual focus.
It's designed to break down the ego, really, and build up this sense of purpose.
There's one moment from that week in Salt Lake that I think just nails the spiritual side of all this. The solemn assembly with President Harold B. Lee.
This is a crucial data point in the narrative. You've got this room full of zealous, maybe a little naive young men, and President Lee opens the floor for questions.
He says, "I don't promise to answer everything, but ask me anything."
And of course, one missionary's hand just shoots up.
He asks, How often does Jesus Christ visit this temple?
It's exactly the kind of question you'd expect, right? He wants that supernatural confirmation, that folklore, to be real.
And President Lee's response was so grounding. He didn't invent some story. He just said, very candidly, that he didn't know.
That feels like a risk for a leader to take.
I think it was calculated, though. He followed up by saying, but this is his house, and he leads this work.
Yeah.
So he validated the sanctity of it all without mythologizing it.
It taught them that faith isn't about knowing all the secrets. It's about trusting the work, a reality check before the real work began.
Which brings us to the move. After a week in that pressure cooker, they're on buses at 5 a.m. But they're not going to Finland.
Not yet. They're going to Rexburg, Idaho.
This was the LTM setup for the Nordic countries at the time. They were going to Ricks College, but they weren't getting the nice dorms.
No. This group of 24, the largest ever sent to Finland at once, was headed for the Pink Palace.
The name sounds almost glamorous, the reality.
Not so much. It was an old apartment building right on the edge of town, literally next to a potato field.
The description of the facilities is where that boot camp feeling really comes back. Bunk beds, of course. But the bathroom situation, I mean, Elder Robery joked it was preparatory for Finland, but it sounds awful.
No doors, just plastic shower curtains hanging from the ceiling around the toilets.
Can you imagine? You're living with 24 other guys, you're completely stressed out, and your only privacy is a sheet of see-through plastic.
And the hot water wars, don't forget that. Elder Robert Jacobson said if you didn't get up at the crack of dawn, it was gone.
So it's a choice between sleep and a warm shower.
And you probably got neither.
But they were living this weird hybrid life, right? They're set apart missionaries in suits and ties, but they're also mingling with regular college kids at Rick's.
Eating in the cafeteria, playing basketball, waiting in line for an iron.
They even cut each other's hair to save money.
Oh, I can just imagine what those haircuts look like.
Probably terrible.
Yeah.
But that friction between being like a monk and living in a college dorm, that created a certain kind of bond.
But let's be honest, the cold showers, the bad haircuts, that was all just background noise. The real villain of the story was the Finnish language.
The linguistic Everest. I knew Finnish was hard, but after reading this, wow, it sounds impossible.
It's what they call a Category 4 language for English speakers. It's not Indo-European at all. It's from the Uralic family. It's agglutinative.
Which means they just glue words together to make meaning instead of using prepositions.
Exactly. And then there are the cases.
Ah, the cases. There's that legendary story in the source about Elder Gary Carter, first day of class. The teacher, Veely Frank Smith Veely, just means brother. He leans over to Carter.
And he asks him, how many cases do you think there are in Finnish?
And Carter, you know, is probably thinking of German or Latin, and he guesses 6.
And Smith just laughs. 15. Welcome to Finland.
15 cases. That means a single noun can change its form 15 different ways. And the vocabulary gives you nothing to hold on to.
Zero. In Spanish or French, you can guess words. In Finnish, hill is meki. Salmon is lohi. Stone is kivi. There's no connection.
And apparently there are over 40 words for snow.
Which tells you everything you need to know about the place they were going. But the real terror wasn't just memorizing words, it was the pronunciation. The stakes were so high.
This is where the double consonant thing comes in.
Yes.
This part, I was laughing, but also my stomach was in a knot.
Explain the difference between meeting and killing.
Okay, so it's all about how long you hold a sound. In Finnish, you pronounce every single letter. If there's a double P, you have to hold that P sound. The word for meeting is tapamasa, one P.
Right, tapamasa, got it. But if you hold it just a little too long, tapamasa with two P's, that comes from the verb tapa.
Which means?
To kill.
Oh no.
So you have these sincere 19-year-olds trying to practice the sentence, we are meeting people with a message of Jesus Christ. But if they get nervous or just stress the consonant wrong, they're literally saying, we are out killing people with the message of Jesus Christ.
That is a very, very different gospel message.
A catastrophically different message. And that fear, that constant fear of saying something violent or blasphemous by accident, it drove them to this intense memorization.
Back to the erase the board method.
Exactly. They memorized the missionary discussions word for word because they couldn't improvise. Elder Shulge even said he'd rehearsed the lines in his head at night just to fall asleep.
That sounds completely exhausting. And, no surprise, people started to crack.
We have to talk about Elder Dennis Dowdle. That part of the story felt really heavy.
It is. Dowdle just hit a wall. He was weeks in, the departure date is getting closer, and he hasn't passed off a single discussion. He just couldn't get the grammar.
And he's watching everyone else succeed, feeling like a total failure.
So he actually goes to Sister Wade, the mission president's wife, and tells her, I'm done. I'm quitting. I'm not going.
And this is where that leadership style is so important. She didn't lecture him or tell him to study harder. She saw it was a spiritual block, too.
She suggested they fast and pray together.
And it worked. He passed his first discussion right after. But it shows you how isolating language learning is. When you can't communicate, you feel like you've lost your entire personality.
You feel like a child again.
And there's another moment that shows that shared vulnerability perfectly. The story about Elder Burke Reese.
He'd had a horrible day, just couldn't get the language right.
Mm.
And Elder Roberry asks him to say the closing prayer for the group in Finnish.
I mean, talk about being put on the spot.
Reese just freezes, the whole group is kneeling, and there's just a silence. He can't find the words. Finally, he just breaks down and says in English, Father, please help us.
And the source says the whole room just started weeping with him.
That's the turning point for the group, isn't it? That shared struggle, it created this brotherhood that was stronger than any grammar drill.
They stopped competing and started carrying each other. They realized they were all in the same boat.
But, you know, being 19-year-old guys, they also dealt with the stress with humor. And nothing was funnier or, I guess, more tragic than the Dear John letters.
Ah, the Dear Johns. A true rite of passage.
They turned it into a spectator sport.
Yeah.
In scripture class, the teacher would ask, anyone get a letter this week? And if you did, you had to go up to the front and read it out loud to the class.
It sounds brutal, but it's a coping mechanism, right? If you can all laugh at the pain, it doesn't have the same power over you.
And there is one letter in this collection that is just, it's Hall of Fame level heartbreak.
The mustache letter. I still can't believe that's real.
Okay, so this poor guy gets a letter. Girlfriend is breaking up with him. Standard. She admits she's now dating his best friend. Also, sadly, pretty standard.
But then she gives the reason why.
She wrote, and this is a quote, I wanted to know what it was like to kiss a guy with a mustache.
That is just so petty. I'm leaving you for facial hair.
The source says the whole room was just rolling on the floor laughing. It's so absurd. And moments like that, that collective laughter, that's what kept them sane.
It bonded them.
So we also have to talk about the physical prep. You can't go to Finland without understanding the sauna. And they didn't wait until they got to Helsinki.
No, they had the Nyborgs. Brother and Sister Nyborg had this Finlandier ranch in Idaho. He'd served in Finland. She was Finnish. He actually went on to become the U.S. ambassador to Finland.
Wow. But at this point, he's just the guy introducing them to thermal shock therapy. He takes them to the sauna cabin and then drops the bomb. You have to go in naked. Birthday suits, the text says.
For a group of conservative American boys in the 1970s, that is a massive culture shock. It goes against every instinct of modesty they have.
They were just standing outside, lounging like Adam. Totally awkward. But then they go in, and the description of the heat is so visceral. The text calls them war-whooping lobsters.
They came steaming out of there. They said the air literally burned the inside of their noses. And then came the traditional plunge into a creek that was only 2.5 feet deep.
That's immersion therapy.
Literally. But the lesson is huge. You cannot impose your American norms on Finland. You have to strip away your inhibitions and your clothes and accept their culture. If you can't handle a naked sauna, you can't handle the mission.
So they survived the language, barely. They survived the heartbreaks and the heat. They're finally ready to go. But the departure from the Pink Palace, It wasn't exactly quiet.
It's the Pink Palace incident.
On the very last night, someone, and the source never says, who decided it would be a good idea to flush cherry bombs or M80s down the toilets.
Not a small prank. It blew out the plumbing, caused major flooding. Elder Roberry had to make that call to the LTM president, President Morton, in the middle of the night.
And Morton was furious. He threatened to cancel their whole flight.
To hold all of them back, which would have been a logistical nightmare with visas and everything, but it just shows the tension. You have these high-energy young guys under immense pressure. Eventually, something had to burst.
Morton let them go, but not before a very stern lecture about representing the Savior. It was a messy end.
A reminder that the college days were officially over. Reality was coming.
And it hit hard as soon as they landed in Finland. I think the most telling moment comes from Elder Darwin Rasmussen.
Rasmussen was the star student, the gung-ho one. He studied so hard for 8 weeks he thought he was ready.
He gets off the plane, he's listening to the locals talk, and he realizes he doesn't understand a single word.
Not one. He literally thought he might be in the wrong country.
And when he tried to speak, the locals would just be polite and say he sounded like a Finn, but he knew they were just being nice.
That's the cold water. The LTM didn't make them fluent. It just gave them enough to survive the first week.
And we should probably put the Finland they were entering into context. This wasn't just reindeer and Santa Claus in the 1970s.
Not at all. Cold War Europe. Finland was walking this delicate tightrope. President Kekkonen was balancing relations between the West and the Soviet Union. The country was urbanizing like crazy, building its welfare state.
So these missionaries were walking into a really complex, sophisticated geopolitical situation
that they barely had the words to describe.
So when you look back at all this, what's the big takeaway? You have this group of kids who went through this boot camp of memorization, cold showers, grammatical terror. Was it actually effective?
Well, if you measure it by immediate fluency, maybe not. Elder Ackerman said by the time they left, they could say prayers and bear testimony, but real conversation was just cobbling together memorized phrases.
It wasn't that magical gift of tongues where you suddenly speak perfect Finnish.
No, it was a grind. But the real transformation wasn't linguistic, it was internal. The gift was the resilience to keep trying, even when you look foolish. It was the brotherhood they built in that pink palace.
They learned how to be uncomfortable, how to fail, and how to lean on each other.
Exactly.
It reminds me of that quote from Elder Lyon at the very end. He looks up at a cloud and he compares it to the city of Enoch descending from heaven.
It's such a beautiful, transcendent image. It shows that despite all the pranks and the plumbing disasters, they were leaving with this profound sense of purpose. They felt like they were part of something huge.
It really makes you wonder about shared hardship. You take any group, lock them in a building next to a potato field, strip away their privacy, give them an impossible task, and force them to rely only on each other. What kind of bond does that create?
It transforms you. You go in as individuals and you come out as a single unit, a cohort.
And maybe that was the real mission all along.
That's it for this deep dive into the Pink Palace and the 15 cases. Thanks for listening.